good afternoon, and thank you ever so much for inviting me. I want to try to show you some evidence that health inequalities are closely related to economic inequalities, and economic inequalities are closely related to the 1%, and that this particularly matters over what's happened in the last 6 years in this country, which has been quite remarkable. We have to go right back to the 1930s to see similar kinds of sudden change following a banking crisis happening. This particular cartoon was published in the Plebs Journal, and so I thought of it because the former chief whip, I think, is in court at the moment, saying he'd never used the word pleb, and Sir Bob Geldof is defending him. But there was a Plebs Journal in the 1930s, and it produced cartoons like this about you weren't really all in it together if you were all stepping down, because at the bottom you drown. And if you know about the history of health inequalities and poor health in Britain, you'll know that the 1930s were a particular bad spike. Mortality rates actually rose in some areas. You can modernise that cartoon just by adding two noughts to the end of each of those figures. If you add two noughts to the end, then you have the £1 million man. That's the 0.1%, if you're getting £1 million a year. The £100,000 a year man, not quite in the 1%. And you have the average man, the £25,000 a year man. If you were updating it, of course, you might make a couple of them women. You'd have to think imaginatively about the hats, because class distinctions are a bit different. And if you were updating it, there's one big difference from what happened in the 1930s. The man at the top would actually have to be stepping up the ladder, because that is what's happening at the moment. The very richest are getting richer. Everybody else is stepping down. We've had a remarkable increase in equality amongst the 99%, about to end because benefit cuts are coming in with a vengeance. But people at the very top have stepped up, and I really think this matters a great deal. And we might just have one slide for the whole. She's going to have to require some imagination over thinking. Anybody know where the keyboard is? I can tell you more. Cartoon was drawn by a geographer.
Either. Just press there.
That'll do.
Or there's something on there.
Thank you. I can just wave my hands, as you're about to discover, for an hour. Okay. If you want slightly less waving of hands, a lot of what I've got to say was published earlier this year in the New Statesman. In an article about why have we seen an increase in the elderly dying in this country, an unreported increase in the elderly dying. When I published the article, Public Health England complained about it. They sent me four emails from four different press offices for Public Health England. I'm very lucky I kept my original copy of the article, which had 27 references in it for all the things I was claiming had happened, at which point Public Health England decided not to say I'd got my evidence wrong and went a bit quiet. But I'm not going to go through all the evidence of things. I'm just going to show you the findings, but if you're interested, that's the place to look. Everything is connected to everything else. So when you have growing and high economic inequality, you end up with worse housing systems. You end up with worse distributions of educational resources, and you end up with a worsening health, and you end up with particular stories which are complicated. Everything isn't completely simple. There are always exceptions. And it's very hard to prove exactly why what has happened has happened. But as you build up enough coincidences, I think you can begin to say that the situation we're living in is unusual, is not like it is in other European countries, doesn't have to be like this. And part of the reason why we have some of the poorest health in Europe is because we are the most unequal country in Europe when it comes to income inequalities. Most of you will be aware of a book called The Spirit Level, I'm guessing, so I don't need to go through that. But The Spirit Level essentially was a story of discovery. The authors of The Spirit Level began to draw some graphs of a social ill against an inequality measure, and they kept on finding a linear relationship, a largely linear relationship. The bigger the gap between the best off fifth and the worst off fifth, the more people were in prison in each country, the higher the rates of mental illness in each country, more people were having babies young, infants were dying more frequently, people were living shorter lives, and so on, and so on. It was the story of the original discovery of a relationship. Not the reason about why the relationship exists, just that there was one. I think it's very similar to when those medics, I think it was in the 1950s, first collected data on doctors and how many of them smoked, and then graphed that against how often they died of lung cancer, and found a relationship between smoking and lung cancer. Doesn't mean they knew why smoking cigarettes tends to increase your chances of getting lung cancer. That's much harder. But just knowing there's a relationship is important. It's most of what you need to know, to be honest, to tell you not to smoke cigarettes if you don't want to get lung cancer. I've also got to talk a lot about what's happened recently, because what's happened recently has been so staggering, and we just don't know where it's going to end. Just give you a couple of examples from housing. About 10 years ago, around about 10% of families were renting privately. Often these were people in between other moves, going into social housing but couldn't get somewhere yet, so renting privately, or between getting a mortgage and moving somewhere else. In the last 4 or 5 years, that proportion of families renting privately has skyrocketed up to over a quarter. So over a quarter of all families with children in England are now renting off private landlords. There's been the fastest ever rise in private landlords in the UK. And if it were to continue for 3 or 4 more decades at this rate, we'd go back to the times of my grandparents, when the majority tenure was having a private landlord. I don't think anybody planned for this to happen, because if they'd planned for this to happen, they'd have done it a bit more carefully. We have an unusually small private rented sector in Britain. You need a larger private rented sector for people who need to move around, for young professionals, and probably for elderly people who suddenly discover they can't go upstairs anymore and need somewhere to move to in a hurry. Nobody was advocating a growing private rented sector for people with kids, because in Britain you can be chucked out with 2 months' notice, and if you're a child, it's generally a good idea to keep the same friends for a length of time and to go to the same school. In London, the average family who are renting privately are being pushed out every year, and what's happening is that they're being pushed out because a couple without children can pay slightly more rent. Rents are going up 9% a year. This is a kind of social disaster that's happened very recently. It happened because of the 2008 crash. House prices went down in 2008. People stopped selling, people stopped buying. Very tiny crash compared to the rest of the edge of Europe. But landlords stepped in, because people still had to move. And landlords stepped in so much and increased the rent and bought houses when people couldn't sell them, that they've increased their wealth since 2008 by 245 billion. At a time when the country is becoming poorer, landlords net have been becoming much richer. And it's predicted that by April next year, by the end of this tax year, in just 1 year, landlords in Britain will have increased their wealth again by almost 110 billion. The revolutionaries who are making these predictions is the newspaper The Financial Times and the estate agent Savills, because they're worried about what's happening. In much of the southeast of England, you're seeing a majority of house purchases are now private landlords. And this is before the rules come in that allow people with very large pension annuities to suddenly buy themselves a flat as well. The average wealth of people who are borrowing to buy a house has actually gone down as house prices in the south have gone up. You now have a cliff, a huge cliff between here and London of 350,000 to get an average house in London, and that cliff is getting wider rapidly. There's very little sign yet of a slowdown in that. This is one estimate of the distribution of wealth in the country that we have now. It's probably an underestimate. It's figures released by accident by ONS and kindly published by George Monbiot, who refused to take them down. The reason why ONS didn't want the figures out there isn't actually because they're so shocking. It's because it's very hard to be sure about the wealth of the top 1%. They might have a lot more than that. They tend to be quite good at hiding what they've got. Just a couple of pieces of recent evidence about inequality being worse. This particular study, published in the journal, International Journal of Epidemiology, showed that in the United States, when Republican presidents were in the White House, all else taken into account, a very big model trying to look at unemployment rates and so on, there was a 3% increase in infant mortality in the United States when the Republicans were in, as opposed to the Democrats. And again, it's going back to this thing of, you can find a relationship, looks like a robust relationship, can get published in a journal relationship, doesn't necessarily mean you know why you're getting that relationship. The United States has the highest infant mortality rate in the rich world, more than double that found in Japan. And this paper, which was published in 2012, looks at wealth inequality. Not income inequality, but wealth inequality. Wealth is the stock of all the assets you have. Income is the flow that comes through every year. Get a high income and don't spend it all, and you will eventually get much more wealth. Get a low income and you've got very little chance of getting more wealth, but wealth is a long-term measure of inequality. And it reveals different things and interesting things for people who are studying this. So although we get what appears to be a fairly strong relationship, a country like Denmark, which has very low income inequality, has high wealth inequality, and has high infant mortality. And it's just interesting to look at Denmark. The reason why Denmark's interesting is that if you're trying to change Denmark, what you do is you move towards having low income inequality. You don't pay people at the top that much, you pay people at the bottom more. And eventually you should get wealth inequalities declining, but it takes time. And the question is, during that time, what is going on to mean that infants in Denmark are not doing that well? And there are many, many possible mechanisms at play. One possible one is that people self-medicate with alcohol when things are worse. So this might be called blaming the victim. But you can look at these things and begin to say, do you actually see worse personal health behaviours during times when you think your prospects are worse? When there's hope, is it easier to look after yourself when you think you've got a chance? And what gives you hope is the society in its way your society's heading. My favourite example of this of all time is how the suicide rate of the elderly in Britain plummeted in 1946 and 1947, before the NHS came in and before pensions came in, because the elderly knew they were coming and they would no longer be a burden on their families. And so they were less likely to kill themselves. Here's the basic relationship between life expectancy and wealth inequality. Again, it's similar for income inequality, to what the spirit level showed, but different. And again, Denmark, this country that we normally say, isn't Denmark wonderful? They're going to be producing half of all their energy by wind power, I think by 2020. You know, what a great country. I think no Green Party, because all the political parties are green. When you ask the Danes what will happen when the wind drops, the answer I got from two members of parliament in Denmark was, we'll turn the washing machines off. And we'll all smell together. And as long as we all smell, until the wind comes again. So, and this is the kind of thing, to me, that's interesting. I take the basic relationship. I don't think countries with great inequalities do very well. But it's these odd exceptions that are worth looking at. The gap's very large, a gap of this size. And life expectancy is the weakest of all the correlations of inequality, partly because many things over a long time can affect life expectancy. ONS produced a report just a couple of months ago on the latest life tables for the country, and they chose to put these countries in. So I just thought I'd show you the very latest data. And you have to ask, why do we not live as long as they do in Japan, Spain and France and Switzerland and Italy, Sweden and Iceland? Iceland after the crash in Iceland. Norway. ONS a bit disingenuously don't put in the UK figure. They divide the UK up into its constituent countries. If you did UK, it would be beneath the Netherlands. There's Denmark again. There's the USA that does worse than Denmark. One large and two small Eastern European countries and Scotland. This graph is comparing six countries, five in Europe and the USA, and it's showing you over time the income share of the best off 1%. In the Spirit Level book, the authors looked at the mean income, the arithmetic average income, the best off fifth to the worst off fifth. What I'd like to argue is that what they were largely looking at was actually the share of the 1%. It's the share of the 1% which drives that. Because at the bottom of society, we don't let incomes go below a certain level because people starve, and so we have a welfare system. They're different in different countries, but there's a ceiling. If you look at the top 20%, what is it which most alters the incomes of the top 20%? It's incredibly skewed by the income of the best off 1% because they get so much more, and that's the most variable part of that income distribution. I'll show you a graph in a minute comparing a Gini coefficient to this. But essentially what I'm trying to get over is you really only have to worry about the 1%. If the 1% take less, in the Netherlands they're now taking just under 7%, by definition, everybody beneath them has to take less, otherwise they'd be in the 1%, and so it really squeezes the distribution. If the 1% take more, in the United States they're now taking over 20%, the group just beneath them try really hard to get as much as they can, because they still don't think they're very well off compared to the 1%. And so your top groups end up costing and taking a great deal more. The reason for showing you this graph is that we've changed the most. In the 1970s, we were the second most equal large European country after Sweden. This was a very different country and very different in comparison to other European countries. Places like Sheffield, where I spent the last 10 years, Sheffield had a mortality rate which was slightly better than the national average in the 1970s. We were bringing in comprehensive schools in the 1970s. For the first time, most children were going to school with most other children. The 70s have had a very bad press because the 70s were a terrible decade if you had wealth, because there was very high rates of inflation, and so your wealth disappeared. And the people who get to write the history of the 1970s tend to have been people associated with that. We don't talk about the 70s as our last decade of full unemployment. Unemployment managed to hit 1 million just at the end of it. But the 70s were a very different decade. And then you'll see we take over European country after European country to get to the point now where the best off 1% are taking 15% of all our income. That's enough to fund the NHS 1.5 times. After tax they take about 10%, because the 1% are paying a third of all income tax, because they pay themselves so much. But still very well off. In normal countries, in average countries, the tax distribution is more even. People at the top pay less tax because they have less income. People in the middle pay more. You don't have a huge group at the bottom who are paid so little that they can't pay any tax, because we actually have to even give them tax credits for them to get by. Here's the rankings for men. Again, remember that the UK would look worse than England looks. And again, you can see how low we are. And again, there are interesting questions about how come countries like France, which are more equal than us, don't do as well for men. But in general, we're pretty bad. We're not as bad as this place. If you want an idea of what happens or what may happen given the direction in which we're going, you need to look at the USA. This is data about the wealth distribution in the USA. It was published in 2012 and the data came from 2007. The reason the data comes from 2007 is that when that data was updated for 2010, the poorest 40% of Americans no longer owned that tiny sliver. They actually had negative wealth, which is quite hard to work out how you draw the map anymore. They were literally in the Atlantic. If you add their housing wealth on, because a small proportion of that bottom 40% has actually managed to buy a house, it got even worse, because they had negative equity on average. It was 2012 by the time that was realised in the States, and that was around about the time when the Obama regime finally increased income taxes in the States for the first time in many, many years. Because if you get into a situation where your bottom 40% have nothing to lose, it is quite scary over what might happen, what is possible. Just want to say a little bit about this rise in the deaths in the elderly in Britain, because I think it's remarkable how it hasn't been reported. This rise occurred over a year and a half. It wasn't simply in winter. By June 2013, it was 23,000 more elderly people than on average had died. Because they were elderly, it wasn't noticed. The bulk of these people were aged over 85, but they were dying at 86 rather than at 90. Most of them were women. When elderly women die a few years earlier than you'd expect, people don't notice. The best example of that is Harold Shipman. Harold Shipman could get away with so many murders for so long because this group were expected to die at some point, weren't being watched that much. And the same thing's happened nationally. The figure now is much higher than 23,000. The excess death figure is much higher. Public Health England, who are the new body created by the current government in place of what they destroyed for public health observance, said it's flu. Said it's the flu. Don't worry, it's the flu. Martin McKee at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine looked at the death certificates with David Stuckler and said only 5.8% are dying of flu, this excess. Only 3.5% of pneumonia. In fact, it's dementia was the leading cause, first cause of death. Public Health England are investigating it now, along with ONS, but it's very slow. Remarkable little public outrage about this group. I suspect that there are at least 10 reasons for this, and I think it would be almost impossible to work out which were most important. But what matters more than anything else is the fact that this has occurred and nobody's terribly worried about it. It's worth saying that. I'll give you one of the reasons, one of the possible reasons to show you how complicated this is. The number of car journeys in Britain in 2009, 10 and 11 fell by 10%. We moved towards our Kyoto target incredibly quickly for reducing pollution. Electricity consumption fell by 10% with the Great Recession. Now, when car journeys fall by 10%, what journey do you not take? And I just have a suspicion that 200-mile drive to see Granny in the old age people's home might be one of the journeys that goes early on. It wouldn't be the car journey to go and pick up the shopping. And that's kind of one of the many things you have to look into if you're trying to work out why did this occur. Was it that we neglected the elderly more than we normally do because we simply couldn't afford the petrol to go and see them as much as we were doing before? That's one of my 10 reasons. There are more serious ones than that. One serious one was in July 2011, if you can remember back to this. 752 care homes were threatened with instant closure because the private equity firm which had bought them had taken all the money out and couldn't pay the landlords anymore. The BBC published this as a piece of business news, whereas it's a massive health story. Now, in the end of the day, those care homes were saved, but the people who were in those care homes had been under threat of eviction and didn't know where they're going. Work that's been done on what happens to elderly people when they're made homeless or threatened with homelessness has shown that it shortens your life expectancy if you think that you're not secure. Another thing which fell. Social care visits plummeted. These are the ones, you know, the local authority funds somebody and they've got 15 minutes to go, take off their coat, make a cup of tea, say hello, wash the sink, help you go to the toilet, put the coat on again, go, get in the car and go and see the next old person. It's a pretty awful job and often you're not paid for the time you spend driving between the elderly people to do it. There's been studies of these visits that suggest that in general they're not actually that helpful. But there's one thing I suspect that they are helpful for. If you turn up and you find that the elderly person is lying on the floor having fallen off the sofa, you're likely to do something about it when you visit. And if you have this collapse in the number of visits because the local authority cuts, you're going to get more people not being saved at the point they could be saved because of that intervention. Again, these are just, I've just given you two of the 10 possible reasons. But what annoys me, and I'll try and get more cheery in a minute, it just annoys me that this isn't investigated, and I think it's because these people are old and because they're women. The equivalent in the 1980s was an absolute rise of deaths amongst young people, in particular young men. Increase in suicides with the recession in the 80s, increase in overdose, heroin came into the country, and so on. And we did notice that. We were not that bothered because these were poor young men, but at least we noticed it. But this particular increase has largely not been looked at. Okay. It's very good to go and visit your relatives in the car. But like I say, everything is connected to everything else, and there are complicated reasons about why economic inequality is related to health inequalities. In general, the richer a country is, the more gasoline it'll consume, and the more gasoline you consume, the fatter you're going to get. And you get fatter because there's no better way of not losing calories than sitting driving. Okay. Now, if we concentrate on the little countries at the end, that's where we are. We're up that end. But we're more towards the USA side of things, because we quite like our cars. We've got our motorways. In the USA, you really have to have a car to get around. There's very bad public transport systems. They're not particularly welcoming of cyclists. And at the extreme in the USA, there's a governor in Texas who opposed the building of pavements because pavements were the beginnings of the road to socialism. So that's, if you're worried about how bad it could get. Now, in more economically equal countries, think Japan is the most economically equal country with its train systems and so on. You have good public transport and you have lots of bikes. Japan has lots of bikes. People in Japan don't break the law. Most law-abiding are the rich countries, except when it comes to bikes. They cycle on pavements. But you cycle slowly on the pavement, and you cycle quickly on the road. In Japan, knowing that somebody owns a car only tells you one thing about them. It's not correlated with income at all. It just tells you that they live in the countryside. That's what car ownership in Japan is about. But in Germany, more efficient public transport system. In Switzerland, a better system. these things always, not completely true, but as you move towards more unequal countries, you tend to find greater self-reliance. I saw figures last night from people advocating cycling that were looking at how do over 65s travel. On an average journey in the Netherlands, 23% of the trips taken by people over 65 are done on a bike. Old people cycle in the Netherlands. In Germany, it's about 9%. In the UK, only 1% of the trips taken by over 65-year-olds on a bike. It's generally good for you to be on a bike, particularly if car drivers are a little bit less selfish and more dangerous. Just some more figures for you. I'm then going to concentrate on Germany and France here, partly because costs are lower in Italy and Spain. Recently, the boss of John Lewis talked about France, I think, as a basket case. Do you remember that? Have a look at the median household income in France. €39,000 for the average family in France. This is supposed to be an economic basket case. And then compare it to the average household income worked out in euros in this country. The French are doing better. The average family in France does better. And this is before you take into account housing costs. It's an incredible difference. We just don't compare our lives with people across the channel. On average, we don't say, let's take this city and compare it to this city. I'm wanting to do this for Oxford. Oxford's twin with Bonn and Grenoble. Compare the schools. Get a shock. They're all state schools over there. Compare the housing. How much space do people get? Compare how they move around. And it's a very salutary thing to begin to do. And why does our average household have less? Because a few people are taking much, much more. Last thing about the elderly, and I really will get it off my chest. But again, and this is the pervasive thing, I think. All kinds of things go wrong in societies. People become more stupid as you become more unequal. They just begin to do really stupid things. To stereotype slightly, if you think about that example of that American saying we won't build pavements because of what it would lead to, it's easy for us to see that that's stupid. So now imagine how many people in many parts of Europe might think about things that we do, and how it might look to them, and it might appear to be normal to us. And here's one example. The National Health Service has tendered out to a private company its publicity for advice to the elderly over what the elderly should do if it gets cold. And what the private company have done is put up web pages. So the 80-year-old surfing the web can look up advice of what, and on the web, it tells you this, and I won't go into partly why this isn't necessarily the best advice, and the problem is, if your room's cold at night, you breathe in the cold air and it gets into your lungs and so on. But just the idea that we're going to reach out to the elderly using the web, paying a private company to do it, is a stupid idea. But stupid ideas become more common in countries with greater inequalities because people become cleverer together. If you look at rates of numeracy, the USA scores worse at tests of numeracy by about age 20 in the rich world. But we're third from the bottom. At the top is Finland and Japan and Norway and Germany and all these other countries where average people can add up and can do those kind of things. And we become worse at it. And our people at the top become worse at it. So our people with all the A's know they've got lots of A's. But when you compare our people with lots of A's with people who've done very well from other parts of the world, but it's more equal, and you come to want to hire somebody to work at a university to do something complicated, say making some maps which look interesting, why do you think we're filling up with European skilled labour coming in and working in our universities from these countries with better education systems? We stand out like a sore thumb in Europe. Every year now the European Commission gathers data from every bank about how many people it employs and pays more than €1 million a year to try to control them. We have 2,700 bankers paid over €1 million a year. The next highest country is Germany with 212. Really is out of kilter. Barclays Bank on its own is paying more people over £1 million a year than they're paid that much in every single industry in the whole of Japan. And Japan functions. It might be going into a second recession, but lots of things work much better in Japan than they work here. It wasn't the flu. It wasn't the cold. 2009-2010 winter was colder. I think it is the callousness, of which the worst side of the callousness is not even complaining about the fact that we have had this increase in deaths and we haven't even investigated it properly. And the worry about that, or for me, what's most scary about that, is one reason you're likely to get change or things are likely to get better in future is that we begin to worry about our old age. If you think what's going to happen to you when you've got a pension, if you've got a pension, when you're bedridden, who's going to care for you, and in what kind of country are you going to do better, you're more likely not to like the way things are going at the moment. But if you just don't want to think about it, and you don't want to think about them, it's possible for it to get worse. Okay, just going to get into the specifics of who is in the 1%. And then we'll do a poll and find out in the room. This is the income distribution of the country according to the Institute of Fiscal Studies. If you're getting over £3,000 a week, or £160,000 a year as a household, as two people, you're in the 1%. £160,000 a year. If you've got a couple of kids, you need about £200,000 a year to be in the 1%. The average is £442 a week. The gap between the two lines is the effect of redistribution at any one point. The bottom 10% would starve and die if it wasn't for benefits, largely pensioners. So the size of that wide gap is equal to the size of the shaded gap higher up, which is the greater tax take on people on higher incomes. This graph can be misleading because it's wrong to look at it at one point in time. John Hills, who's an economist at the LSE, has published a book last week, I think called Not Them and Us, titled something like that. And what John Hills has done is shown that over the course of our lifetimes, middle class people, upper middle class people, people in the bottom of the top fifth, say, are getting more out of the welfare state than poor people. Essentially, most people get out of the welfare state what they put in taxes. There's one really simple reason for this. Middle class people live for about 10 years longer. And in those extra 10 years, they make greater use of social services, greater use of the NHS, and so the higher taxes that they're actually paying while they're paid higher, they actually end up getting back anyway. They might spend their lives moaning about how they're helping unemployed people be skivers, but the real drain on the welfare state is from the highest taxpayers, apart from the 1%, who disproportionately don't use the NHS, don't use state schools. And if you talk to people in the 1%, ask why they're being asked to pay so much tax when all the council does for them is collect the rubbish. And here we have a problem, I think, in the country. Okay, for those of you who think I'm going on about the 1% too much, here's a series of countries. The USA is at the top. That's the take of the 1% on the y-axis. And on the x-axis, you've got the Gini coefficient. Just to show you how much it's driven by the take of the 1%. It's not about the politics of envy worrying about the 1%. In fact, I can go on if you want to ask later, but I wouldn't necessarily be envious of being in the 1%. The vast majority of people in the 1% are not aware they're in the 1%. They think they're not doing very well and they need more. There are other things. But if you want a more equal society, the 1% simply have to have less, and they won't do it by themselves. They won't volunteer to do it. People often say it's impossible, we're in a more globalised world, it's more technological, inequality just rises over time, and so on. And they say it because they haven't even bothered to look at the data. This is the take of the 1% over time in Switzerland and the Netherlands. the take of the 1% can go down. But it requires a country and a society that thinks that's a good idea for it to happen. I think the worst damage is done when fundamental ideas are changed. And the fundamental idea that was changed most in this country in the early 1980s was the idea that there is no such thing as society. There is only you and your family. And the problem with that is all kinds of things go wrong. If there's only you and your family and your middle class, you become your own little welfare state. You, your mum and dad, your brothers and sisters have got to look after each other because you're not going to rely on £10 job seekers' allowance a day. And the kind of thing that happens in housing is that elderly people hang on in houses, 4 or 5 bedroom houses, even if they find it hard to heat those houses, say they'd rather not be in the house. They stay in that house for the good of their family, because the longer you stay in the house, the higher it'll go up in price, and then you can give a higher inheritance to your family. This makes sense for a family. You end up with 30 million empty bedrooms in the country, largely in the private sector, and the housing crisis, if you're just trying to look after yourself and your family. It must be slightly disingenuous. I'll send this picture. But it must be slightly disingenuous. But different places have different minimum wages. Just try to think about how you get through life on a particular wage, or if you go from the minimum to the living wage. In Oxford, that is, for a cleaner who works 20 hours a week, going from the minimum to the living is about £10 extra a week, 50p an hour. £10 extra a week is £500 a year. £500 a year lets you buy a second-hand computer from somebody so your children can do their homework. It's an incredible change that occurs. Almost got to the end now of this, and I'm sorry it's been a bit of a rant. I find it hard not to get a bit ranty over some of it. A lot of the evidence is circumstantial, but it's mounting up and it's getting stronger and stronger and stronger. There's another review coming out. It's been 160 reviews in academic papers about this. These things looking very strong, and claims about causal relationships as well, which we could talk about. But I've also pointed out the exceptions. Strange things like Denmark, other things going on that we need to know. And also, just how many reasons there could be for this relationship. I'll give you one last one. In more equal countries, more average people become doctors. Because in more equal countries, there aren't big class differences between you. So you're more likely to become a doctor if you want to spend the rest of your life with ill people. That is what a doctor is. It's somebody who's going to spend their life with ill people. You're also more likely to realise that what being a doctor is spending your life with ill people. In a country like Britain, you're more likely to be pushed at the age of 16 and 17 towards applying for medicine if you've got all the high A levels. And to be honest, a salary of under £100,000 isn't something you can think of living off. So unless you're going to be a lawyer or a banker, what else is there? Medic. Well, I'm stereotyping, but not that much. When I was at Newcastle University, my best friend was a dentist. He'd grown up in Pakistan. He came here at the age of 10, and he applied to do dentistry because he'd seen people suffering with really bad problems with their teeth. He couldn't believe it when he turned up in his first week and told me that everybody else in his course wanted to be a dentist because they couldn't become a doctor, but they did want money. I mean, he was stereotyping slightly. But how many people say, I want to be a dentist because poor people in this country tend to die with 8 less teeth than rich people in this country? So, going back to the doctors, we tend to get posher people apply to medical school. They get in, they get their medical qualifications, and then where do they want to live? They don't want to live in poor areas. We know they don't want to live in poor areas because we can't recruit them in poor areas. We have more GPs on the NHS living in rich areas. because it's hard for them to adapt and to be there. In a more equal country, you don't have so many rich and poor areas. You can get your doctors more evenly distributed around the country. And if doctors do anything that's any good for health at all, that's one of the reasons why health inequalities are lower and health is better. The problem is there are lots of potential reasons. They just tend to go in the same direction. Singapore. I need to tell you a little story about Singapore. Last year they had an exhibition in Singapore where they showed the death list from the Titanic. These are the lists of the number of passengers in the first class who were saved and who died, second class, third class, mainly dead, and the crew, bless them, actually died at a higher rate than the third class. Recently it's been said that in Britain, if you look at the survival rates in the six hours after the iceberg hit the Titanic, you get similar rates for the 6 years after you're 65 by social class. Now, it's very similar. But the irony of Singapore, and again exceptions. This graph comes from the Equality Trust, which was the trust set up after the Spirit Level book was published. And it's showing you that general relationship between inequality. They got told off for not putting numbers on their axes, but it really doesn't matter. You can find the numbers out yourself. And infant mortality. So again, the USA's at the top, these are rich countries, Japan's at the bottom. But here, Singapore, you can have a very unequal country with very low infant mortality. So what's going on? And this is a model for Britain. Because if you hear some politicians talking in London, they say we need to be looking at Singapore. Singapore is the future. Singapore is modern. Why don't we become more like Singapore? Singapore is clean. It's efficient. It has very big inequalities, but it houses people very well. It actually has 80% of people in council houses, in effect. And they don't yet point to this. And neither does the government in Singapore point to this. And I suspect the reason is they do have a remarkably good health system, health service in Singapore, but they also pregnancy test 100,000 maids every 3 months. It used to be every 6 months. They're now pregnancy tested every 3 months. These are the servants, because when you become this unequal, you have servants again. And if you're found to be pregnant, you have to leave the country. You lose your job. Okay? If you want to get a really low infant mortality rate, imagine telling people who are the poorest people in Britain, we're going to pregnancy test you every 3 months, and if we find you're pregnant, you've got to leave the country. People try very, very hard not to get pregnant. If they get pregnant, they find a way to have an abortion, because they need to have their job. If they keep the baby, they go abroad and have the baby, back where their mum is, and leave the baby with mum and come back to be a maid in Singapore. And if the baby dies, that baby isn't dying in Singapore. And this is why the Singapore government doesn't celebrate the fact it has the lowest infant mortality rate in the world. But it's why it is never completely simple. There is story after story after story. But we shouldn't be looking there. We should know about there, but we shouldn't be looking there. We need to be positive. It's far too easy to rant. It is actually quite hard to be positive. But we need to be positive. And the reason we need to be positive is so many places in the world manage to do things better than we do now. It's not as if we're in a position where we have to think, what could we possibly do to improve things? How can we do it? We're not Norway. We're not Japan. I don't quite know what you'd do if you're a social scientist in Norway. try to defend what you've got. But we should be optimistic because you can see how much better it can be. You can also see that this can be achieved relatively cheaply. I mean, for me, by far the best way to improve living standards in this country and get greater equality is to begin to say that house prices coming down would be good. not very hard to say. Politicians can't say it. Although Grant Shapps said it as housing minister. He said house prices should go up 2% less than wages. So you can work out how low they should be. If house prices were to come down, then the major expense that most people have, which is a mortgage or the rent, falls. If it goes down year after year after year, say heading towards German levels of house prices, it's like 1,000 trade unions winning all their pay claims every year, but for everybody. And if house prices head in that direction, and you're an elderly person hanging on in a house for the good of your family that's too large for you, you can't afford to heat it, and the value of the house is falling, the faster you get out of that house, the better off your family's going to be. See, all kinds of things. And how much does it cost the country for house prices to fall? It doesn't. It saves the country money. It costs some people who own big houses money. They become less rich. Some landlords will be unhappy, but they're not going to demolish their housing. But politicians, for some reason, have to tell us, don't worry, we're all going to be rich eventually. You all need to aspire to get a mortgage. You all need to pay that mortgage off. Somebody will come along in 20 years' time and buy your house for £500,000 or £1 million. Even though it's quite hard to see where they're going to come from. And you and your family will do fine as long as you're hardworking enough. They can't say this is a stupid way to behave and it can't work. And only 1% of people can be in the 1%. Thank you very much. I noticed at the railway station here that John Ronson's book, The Psychopath Test, is still, amazingly, is number 4. After 3 years, not that I'm jealous and wish I could write, but if you haven't, buy The Psychopath Test. It's, I mean, it's a popular book because it lets you work out whether your boyfriend or girlfriend might be a psychopath. People obviously are worried. Every society has people with those beliefs in them. It doesn't matter, very nihilistic beliefs. What most societies manage to do most of the time is control those people and certainly not let them get to the top. Extreme. Think of 1930s German inequality and, what happens. And so that's the danger. That's the danger. You can get this kind of thinking being allowed out and then presented as normal, and you have a big shift of your culture to a more individualistic culture. The opposite happened in the 1930s. Oswald Foulkes, who was a banker, said that the main thing Keynes did wasn't his great theory, it was he helped change the moral sentiment of the country so that greed began to be seen as being very, very bad after the 1929 crash. But people had to argue for it. It didn't suddenly happen. There was a huge amount of debate. The quote I think I'm going to have to learn the quote, but it's from the play The Inspector Calls. At the end of The Inspector Calls, the play about when the young woman was found to be dead, they were all responsible for it. The fact that that had to be put into that play, which was about the 1920s or 30s, but written in the 40s, it's only a telling phrase at the end of that play because those people could not care about the fact that the young lady had killed herself because she was unimportant. And he had to do that before. But I would please email that one because I will use it if you do.
I think this will be our last question, so no pressure.
It kind of relates to the last two, actually. So there was a time when prices went to petrol, trucks and, you know, tractors would get out and start striking. And how can that, why have we stopped doing that? What's your thoughts on
that? Why isn't there more protest? Yeah. We don't report the ones that there are. Around the world, there's been an increase in protests since the crash. There was a big protest by students against tuition fees. I think it was the day before yesterday, but it was very unreported, partly because the BBC is extremely scared. They've already had the six-year licence fee taken away. They're told if they're not neutral, and the government has a particular definition of neutral, which includes... They're not allowed to use the word inequality in the purdah before the election. The inequality is seen as a left-wing issue, and the BBC are not allowed to talk about it in that period before the election. And that part of the reason you're not seeing a rise in protest is that... But also, these were very personal things about people's individual livelihoods and whether they could carry on. Where I see the most protest, again, this is Oxfordshire again, all across Oxfordshire, there are plans to build 100 homes on the edge of many villages. And in those villages, you enter the village, and there's this huge sign saying no to homes. There's incredible NIMBYism. And if you could only use that NIMBYism, which makes sense, because it's stupid to put the homes there, because you just get more cars, because there are no jobs in the villages. If you could take the power of that NIMBYism and turn that into those people saying, we don't want the homes here, but you really need them here, where you can cycle to work, that would be helpful. My very last example to give you, because I never thought I'd see this. We have a detention centre on the edge of Oxford called Campsfield, which is the country's largest detention centre for asylum seekers. And academics have been trying for 20 years to get it closed. They've recently announced that they're going to try to triple it to 610 inmates, so it becomes Europe's largest concentration centre for asylum seekers. The campaign against it's grown. It's on the north of Oxford, inside a little village called Kidlington. For the first time ever, people in Kidlington have got together to protest against the detention centre growing, which has razor wire on the outside, because they've suddenly figured that you do not want your village being associated with Europe's largest detention centre for asylum seekers. So it's using the power of NIMBYs, who are worried about their house prices, to reduce that. And on top of it, and even in these times with the by-election we're getting later, the local Conservative MP has begun a petition against the detention centre. The most amazing, again, because people are worried about their house prices. Now, it's all a mess, but I could never have predicted that almost certainly the detention centre will fail in January to get planning permission to expand, even while these main political parties are trying to get UKIP votes because of this. So it's hard to predict. If you want to think about where protests might come from, think about people's parents. Young people may not find protesting to be that easy, but these parents who spent all this time doing people's homework so they can get good A-levels, to get them into universities, so they can get good jobs. Just how angry are parents going to get when their kids end up so precariously employed, having to be interns, having to pay enormous rent to landlords? Right? The young people might blame themselves. The sad thing is that's what happens at first. People blame themselves. If only I tried harder, I'd have got that permanent job that I know one person's got. But their parents are not going to blame their children for being crap. Because parents, you know, they know what their children are like. And there's a potential source, but it just has to be harnessed to... Well, you need to have a permanent job, you need to have enough money, you need to be able to feed yourself, you need to be able to have a decent life, but you can't all become rich. And you need that as an aspiration, rather than aspiring to get everybody into the 1%. Thank you very much.